The headlines. Iran's president tells the regional conference that state sponsors of terrorism should not be allowed to set the rules of the war on terror. Iraqi lawmakers elect Abdel Latif Rashid as president, paving the way for the formation of a new government. And a senior Russian security official reiterates Moscow's vehement opposition to Ukraine's NATO membership, saying, quote, it would trigger World War III. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president says those states that loot the riches of independent nations in the name of war of terror can never be trustworthy partners.
We should note that countries which themselves breed terrorists should not define rules and regulations of fighting terrorism. Bullies which have taken the global financial system hostage and keep plundering the wealth of nations cannot be reliable partners in shaping the new order.
Raisi made the comments hours ago at the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia, known as SICA. He added that hegemonic powers are seeking to destabilize independent countries and hamper their progress and convergence. Iran's president urged countries in the region to work together closely to foil the superpowers' plots and to ensure security and stability in Asia. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi touched upon attempts by hegemonic powers to put pressure on Iran using sanctions and threats in order to secure their own interests.
International bullies led by the U.S. have always wanted to go against the will of the Iranian nation and challenge its rights and interests. Throughout all these years, Iranian people have faced different threats such as war, sanctions, terrorism, coup attempts, and breach of promises.
President Raisi said Iranians have invalidated Washington's military option against Iran. He said the White House itself has admitted that its so-called maximum pressure policy against Tehran has ended up in an embarrassing failure. According to Raisi, now that the U.S.'s militarism and sanctions policy have failed, it has opted to destabilize Iran. But he said the Iranian nation has terrified the U.S. and its allies by relying on its own power and seeking to both make progress and ensure its security. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says he does not trust the U.S. and cannot accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem. Abbas made the comments in a meeting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Kazakhstan. There they attended the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia. The Palestinian president said that he can only accept America's role in resolving the conflict with Israel within the quartet of international mediators. That's made up of the U.S. and UN, as well as Russia and the EU. Abbas said that he is completely satisfied with Russia because it stands by justice and international law. He has previously expressed criticism of the U.S. on various occasions over its support for Israel and turning a blind eye to the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people. Palestinians have staged a general strike in occupied outlets in solidarity with the people of the Shafat refugee camp in its nearby town of Annata. Israel has placed a complete lockdown on the camp and the town after a Palestinian operation left the regime soldier dead and another wounded. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
A general strike and civil disobedience have been observed in occupied East Al-Quds and in many areas of the occupied West Bank to reject Israel's siege on Shafat refugee camp and Annata town, northeast Al-Quds. Since Saturday, the Israeli military has kept over 130,000 Palestinians in the two areas under forced lockdown after sealing all military checkpoints. The siege has disrupted residents' vital interests. It has prevented them from accessing the rest of the city for work, school, and medical care and other necessities in severe violation of their basic rights. Israeli military says the move comes as they are searching for a Palestinian gunman who killed an Israeli female soldier at a checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat on Saturday.
What goes on in these actions by the Palestinians are a normal response to the Israeli brutality and aggression against Shafat refugee camp and Annata town. The strike is meant to lift the siege imposed on Shafat and Annata, Al-Quds, Qalandia refugee camp, and other towns. We all responded to the call of civil disobedience and strike.
Also on Wednesday, the Israeli forces imposed a closure on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a day after an Israeli soldier was shot dead near an illegal settlement in the area. In addition to the major military checkpoints surrounding the city, dirt mounds have been placed on the Nablus area roads by military bulldozers to prevent Palestinians to use alternative exits. A manhunt is still underway to find the shooter. Israeli media revealed that the military was considering launching a large-scale operation in the northern West Bank in a bid to end the recent phenomena in struggle, armed struggle.
The resistance of the Palestinian people, and especially the armed resistance, as it happened in Jenin, and it moved to Nablus, and now from Nablus, we hope that it will be spreading all over the West Bank in order to resist this occupation. The phenomena that we are witnessing today in Nablus, this is the new way for the Palestinians to express their anger of this occupation, especially and particularly that all other political solutions is totally failed.
In recent months, the Israeli army have launched near daily raids to the West Bank, mainly in Jenin and Nablus, where Palestinian armed resistance is becoming more organized and new groups of fighters have been formed, the most popular now known as the Lion's Den.
Despite Tel Aviv's heavy-handed crackdown and collective punishment of Palestinians, they are keeping up their resistance against the regime using different tools. Every day, the Palestinians prove that the Israeli military's aggressive measures have failed to weaken their struggle. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Palestinian resistance groups and factions in the occupied West Bank and Gaza have agreed on an Algerian-brokered reconciliation initiative aimed at resolving outstanding issues among them. Following a meeting in Algeria, representatives of Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, Fatah, have accepted and approved the draft statement for Palestinian national peace. Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh has welcomed the agreement, saying that the talks had a positive atmosphere. The General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, Mustafa Barghouti, has talked of a full agreement reached among all Palestinian groups on all issues, including the formation of a national unity government. Apart from hosting the meeting, Algeria has also pledged to follow up on the peace process. Moving on now to Iraq, where lawmakers have just elected Abdel Latif Rashid as new president. That was the fourth attempt this year to elect a new president. Abdel Latif Rashid is a veteran Kurdish politician and a former water minister. He's replacing Barham Saleh. Rashid has named Mohammad Shia al-Sudani as prime minister designate. Iraq has been without a government since parliamentary elections in October of last year. That is when the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's political party won the most number of seats. But Sadr failed to form a government, asking his party's lawmakers to resign. He then asked for the dissolution of parliament and early elections. That prompted a wave of deadly protests in Iraq. Amid the ongoing efforts to find a solution to the years-long war in Yemen, a Saudi delegation has arrived in Sana'a to verify the names of the prisoners to be exchanged under a swap deal agreed upon in Amman. Dr. Latif al-Washali has more in this report from Sana'a.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege, and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Msuya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken against the Yemeni people. Following the failure to renew the UN brokered truce and the military parades of the Sana'a government, the international community is making new moves to find a more reliable agreement that satisfies both sides and ends the sufferings of millions of Yemenis. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
An explosive device has gone off on a military bus in Syria, leaving dozens of soldiers dead or injured. Local reports say the blast took place southwest of the capital, Damascus, killing at least 18 soldiers and injuring 20 others. Syrian authorities have not yet commented on the attack, and no one has taken responsibility for it. A similar bus explosion killed at least 11 government troops and two civilians in the northern Syrian city of Raqqa in June. The Daesh terror group, which claimed responsibility for that attack, has been targeting military personnel in the past few years. We spoke to a correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, earlier. He told us about the possible motives behind the attack.
If you ask analysts about the timing of this particular explosion, it's definitely, they will answer you that it is definitely because of the recent developments. We all know that the Syrian army defeated the terrorists, particularly in Idlib and its countryside in the past couple of years. And also, we're seeing recently some talks happening on the intelligence levels between Turkey and Syria, which might pave the way for restoring relations and for Turkey giving up on those armed groups in Idlib. So this terrorist attack could be committed by terrorist sleeper cells affiliated to those armed groups in Idlib, and they're expressing perhaps anger over such developments and their defeat.
Lebanon has received what is reportedly the final draft of a deal, which has taken over 10 years to demarcate its southern border and to begin drilling in its maritime waters.
A deal to demarcate Lebanon's southern maritime border seems to be in its final stages. After back-and-forth draft proposals, Lebanon was given the final copy, which Lebanese President Michel Aoun believes could pull Lebanon out of the abyss. Prime Minister Miqati stressed after meeting President Aoun that the deal could change Lebanon's status.
We met with the representative of the petroleum company Total, and we agreed that it will begin practical steps toward drilling once this agreement is finalized, and we pray it will be for Lebanon's best interest.
At the Lebanese parliament, several lawmakers stressed that they are waiting to read the details of the final draft in order to make things official.
We have submitted a written request that we would like, and by the law, and it's constitutional, that this deal, this, you know, very, very important deal, is discussed at the parliament level, and we give our opinion about it based on fact and based on clear information.
Despite criticism from foes of President Aoun and Hezbollah, observers see that it would not have been possible to get any of Lebanon's rights in its natural resources without the resistance movement, which played its strongest cards in the last 2 weeks. Even with a deal and prospect of a petroleum-rich country, concerns remain about the ballgame over the revenues.
If there is some oil and gas in Qana field, of course it will have some return on Lebanon, but it is not going to be on the hands of today's powers in Lebanon, because these are overwhelmed with the criticism on corruption, mismanagement of the country, and therefore there should be these returns should be managed by sovereign fund.
Hezbollah's Secretary General considered that the deal needs to be approached objectively, with a national spirit, and stressed that the resistance movement will remain cautious until it is signed. With a lack of consensus on a president for Lebanon and a deepening political stalemate in forming a cabinet, many Lebanese believe the only ray of hope could be through a maritime border deal, which awaits ratification. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The war in Ukraine is escalating to new proportions, with Russia firing missiles to more than 40 towns and cities. Ukrainian officials say the latest round of shelling has targeted the port city of Mykolaiv, and that a settlement in the region of the capital Kiev has been hit by explosive drones. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Air Force has also carried out 32 strikes on 25 Russian positions in the past 24 hours. The recent clashes come amid simmering tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine. Wednesday, a UN General Assembly resolution called Moscow's annexation of Ukrainian territory illegal. Additionally, Ukraine's Western allies have committed to more military aid. Russia, on the other hand, has repeated its objection to the West's growing involvement in the war. The Deputy Secretary of Russia's Security Council has even warned that the admission of Ukraine to NATO could trigger World War III. Germany and over a dozen of its NATO partners plan to jointly procure air defense systems that they say will protect their territory from missiles.
This is a common approach to our joint responsibility for the security of our continent. And we do this by pooling our resources in order to achieve political, financial, and technological synergy effects and thus close the European gap in the field of ground-based air defense.
The German defense minister was speaking at the NATO headquarters in Brussels. The initiative is called the European Sky Shield and comprises half of NATO's members. The Israeli and American systems among their options. The development comes as the West and Russia ratchet up war of words over Ukraine, now over the use of nukes. The NATO chief, Jens Stoltenberg, has threatened Russia with severe consequences if it launches a nuclear attack on Ukraine. The EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, has also said that the Russian army will be, quote, annihilated in case of such attack. Russia has said that it will use nuclear weapons if its security is threatened. British families bracing for a tough winter as officials are working on plans to convince citizens to save energy amid steep shortages. Chief Executive of Britain's energy regulator, Jonathan Brearley, will be asking consumers today to start cutting down on consumption where possible. Ofgem is launching a campaign to help households reduce their electricity and gas usage. But just less than a week ago, the Climate Minister, Graham Stewart, gave assurances that the country will not ask people to use less energy. UK's National Grid, which manages Britain's power and gas systems, has already warned of rolling three-hour blackouts. Britain has been dealing with soaring gas prices and high inflation. It accuses Russia of using energy as a weapon in retaliation for Western sanctions and their support for Ukraine. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Congratulations to all our Arabi listeners on the occasion of 17th of Rabi al-Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this very auspicious occasion.
Birthday of the Prophet of Islam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabi al-Awwal is believed by Shia Muslims as the birthday of the Prophet of Islam. Stay tuned for a special feature in this regard. Five 570 years after the birth of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, on 17th of Rabi al-Awwal, very queer events took place in the world. All idols fell down and broke into pieces. the palace of the Sasanid Emperor of Iran shook, and 14 turrets of the palace collapsed. The Save Lake, as the place of worship of fire worshippers, dried up. The Fars Fire Temple went out after 1,000 years of burning. A light shone from Hejaz and could be seen everywhere in the world. Devils were scared. The magic of magicians was null, and no king was able to speak. On this day, all creatures on earth and in the sky were happy as the best creature, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was born. God endeared him among people and safeguarded him from every evil and harm. Then, as he reached the age of 40, God bestowed all sciences of both worlds to his heart and gave him the mission to guide the world people towards salvation. According to some of the Sunni sources, the Prophet introduced a few things as the principles of Islam. These things are monotheism, prophethood, daily ritual prayers, zakat, hajj, and fasting of Ramadan. Shia prominent scholar Sheikh Ya'qub Kolaini has narrated from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, that Islam has been based on five things: daily ritual prayers, zakat, fasting, hajj, and velayat, God-given authority of the Ahlul Bayt, while velayat is superior to other four items. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says that testifying the oneness of God, belief in the Prophet's mission, spending of zakat, and accepting the velayat of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt are the principles without which nobody's faith will be accepted. God says in the Quran that unity is the cause of superiority, while discord is the cause of decadence and failure. God says in Ayah 103 of Surah Al-Imran, "And hold fast to Allah's cord and do not be disunited." This ayah also considers brotherhood among Muslims as a divine favor. Hoisting the flag of monotheism has always been the common goal of all Muslims in the Islamic Ummah. All Muslims consider the Prophet as their best guide and leader. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has thus been the axis of unity for Shias and Sunnis. The Prophet would advise Muslims to obey divine rulers, as it will guarantee unity and will consolidate the pillars of brotherhood among them. Then, the divine mercy will encompass them as the spring rain. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that leadership in the Islamic Ummah is like the string which gathers all beads of the rosary. Thus, if this string is broken, all beads will be dispersed. The Imam reminds Muslims of the fate of Israelites, saying, "Look how the Israelites were. Once they had gathered together, thoughts and hearts were the same. Hands and swords were helping each other. Visions were deep and decisions were the same. Then, didn't they have great cities round the earth, and didn't they rule the world people? So, look at their end. When differences emerged among them, kindness was undermined. Words and hearts were different. They were divided into groups. They killed one another. They became dispersed and fought each other. Thus, God took off their attire of dignity and deprived them of his ample bounty. and what has remained from them is the source of admonition for those who will be admonished. All prophets and divine leaders have reminded us of God's precedence. God says to his prophet in Ayah 43 of Surah Fatir, "So you will never find any change in Allah's precedent, and you will not find any revision in Allah's precedent." The prophet of Islam says in this regard, "Do not bolt your differences. Those before you did this and were destroyed." He also says, "He who gets away one span from the Muslim community, God will take away the cord of Islam from his neck." Let us gather round the axis of unity, the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Hidden files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugarcane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American-European front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule. During a time when slavery was the norm in many countries, Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed, and those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to this story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about it's 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. It's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for such a country that, for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. So you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? Your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative. Met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004, the year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti, and the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protests, set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that Black people, these Black people, are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, there's you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the Blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the Blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think ever, you know, so if you see that, and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released, and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying, we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, I mean, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S.-led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane, and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military. U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way that they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war, so a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that. But under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group, the membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States, and they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France after he was elected to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in Libya and Algeria and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech. the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out minute day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations, right? So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. For example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations. But what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back. That you have this coup d'etat. I mean, to be fair, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by a landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre, now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had that acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no one would no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that it was, you're impoverishing the country, because, you know, it got so bad, and then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently, right? So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom, right? The paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very... The U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it, like, you know, pan-European, like, white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't stay that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if you're just like, you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not, the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia, but the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the U.S., the U.N. to get out. They want the U.S. to remove, take down this puppet prime minister that they put in place that they don't want, because it's under this puppet prime minister that's allowing all of these things to happen. And I have to say, there's illegal mining going on in Haiti. These puppet governments have basically signed over all of Haiti's mineral resources, and the country's rich with mineral resources. They're oil companies drilling right on the outside, on the outskirts of the island. And so we have to think about the fact that if Haiti is so poor, why is it that every day there are like four flights from Miami, Florida to Haiti filled with white businessmen going to Haiti to make money, right? So there's that. And so what Haitians want is they want this so-called, this prime minister that's implicated, by the way, in the assassination of the president, right? And the U.S. knows that. The U.S. has all the evidence. They want the prime minister to come down. They want the UN to leave Haiti. And they want the space for Haitian, they always say this, Haitian solution. And, you know, before Jovenel Moïse was the president that was assassinated, before he was assassinated in July, there are a bunch of groups that came together in February 2021. And, you know, it was like a coalition for, you know, coming up with a Haitian solution. And there are several groups. One is called the Montana Group, that basically laid out a plan, a two-year plan for the transitional government, elections, and so on. Well, the U.S. refused to take heed. And not only did they refuse to take heed, they managed to actually, incorporate some of these individuals, right? Managed to get them so that they could basically follow through and then try to gain favor with the U.S. And so then that basically just took out all the active radical elements from the group. And basically the group just was destroyed. And so now the U.S. is talking about a Haitian solution, but it's handpicked. It has handpicked those who are supposed to come up with a Haitian solution. So what we need is to be left alone. These people need to leave us alone. They need to leave the country, leave us alone, and we will figure it out. And we're not even being allowed to do that. They won't leave. You know, they won't leave the country. They won't stop, intervening. And until they do, it's going to be a mess. And I think at this point, Haitians have had it. And I think they're willing to continue protesting. And I have to also say, these current protests have been going on for 6 weeks, but you would never know that, right? Because you would never know that they've been protesting, asking the UN to leave.
Wow, really interesting. Dr. Pierre, do you have any final comments for our viewers?
Well, I just want to say, I hope people watching this will take the time and understand the situation is not an exceptional situation in the sense that Haiti is so different from the rest of us, the rest of the world. We're suffering from Western imperialism. And so if we understand Haiti and Haitian people as real human beings, not just, these people who won a revolution 200 years ago, real human beings with real needs and need to have access to their own sovereignty and their self-determination, I hope the rest of the world will join us in that fight against the Western imperialism that is really holding, that is keeping us under their boot.
All right, and we hope the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us here on the program, Dr. Pierre. The story of Haiti is one of a country with so much potential, so many resources, but one which has been sabotaged. Many of its members of its upper class have worked in cahoots with Western governments to steal all they can and to create chaos on the island. The real story is the wealth that has been stolen that needs to be returned. This is another story of colonialists and imperialists being held responsible and made to repay what they've stolen, though they can never really repay it. It is estimated that currently France should repay at least $120 billion for the money that it extorted from Haiti. And then the United States should be held responsible for its theft and causing instability in Haiti. There are groups that are taking these demands for reparations to the international community, but will it make a difference? What we know is that the Haitian people are revolutionary and resilient, and we hope that while they are on the streets demanding justice, that this will ultimately lead to their real independence and empowerment. Well, like all of our other files we've mentioned, we will continue to follow up on Haiti, the affluent nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time. I'm Marzia Hashimi for Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.